that place, Hamakom. We'll talk about it in a second. Thank you, Michal. She's from my gang, so she applauses the whole time. We have some children with us today, so that's really, really nice. Hello. And Zohar, where is Zohar? Also here. So hello. Okay, so we're very happy to be here for some reasons. I mean, one reason is that I love this place. This is my second time in Krakow, and the all this idea of this evening that I will elaborate about it in a second is about a place, Makom in Hebrew. So I love this place. The second thing is that my father was born a few blocks down here in Krakow many years ago, if I may say, and he's having his birthday on this Thursday. So I'm dedicating this show to my father, whom I love very, very much, and I'm very inspired by him. And he brought me back to Krakow a few years ago, and today he is back in Israel, so I'm saying hello and I love you. Thank you, Daddy, for that. The third reason why I'm very happy to be here is because of this special format. On this beautiful stage that has beautiful carpets on it are going to be five different artists from five different artistic fields. A graphic designer, an artist, a podcast artist, we'll talk about it in a few minutes, a fashion designer, and and a musician, of course. Thank you. And they're all going to come here on stage and talk about their creations, but they're going to do it in maximum 10 minutes. So in less than 50 minutes, you're going to meet five different artists from different artistic fields, four from Israel and one from here, from Krakow. And you're going to hear what they want to say about Makom, about this thing called place. And the fourth and last reason why I'm very, very happy to be here is that all of the artists that we curated for tonight are women, which is pretty special, and woman power, and we're happy for that. So, yeah. Thank you. Makom, Hebrew, in Hebrew, place, in English. In the translation, you know how to say it now in Polish as well. We all come from a makom. We all come from a certain place. That place tells a lot about who we are. We are established by the makom that we were born in and that we live in. We are programmed, if you want, through the makom that we live in, that we came from. And maybe we can do a little bit small scratch in the makom that we live in and come out of it. So in the next 50 minutes, we're going to hear five different stories and five different presentations about makom. Every 10 minutes, we're going to move from a different discipline. And they're all going to share with you on this beautiful stage. I think we're ready to start. So thank you once again for coming. And we want, with your warm applause, to bring the first presenter. She's a graphic designer from Israel. Her name is Liron Lavi, and she has a beautiful story to share with you. Please.
Good evening, everyone. Imagine walking in a place that you can't read a third of the signs in it. And now, even worse, imagine not even realizing that you can't read a third of the signs. You just ignore some of them. This happened to me. I grew up in Haifa, in Israel. And you may know that in Israel, every sign has three languages on it. It has Hebrew, Arabic, and English. I've never learned Arabic. And one day, when I was walking down the street, I suddenly realized that actually I'm looking at the Arabic as if it's just ornaments. Some decorations, really nice ones, but not a language that you really need to read and content that you need to understand. This really surprised me and bothered me, especially because I know, and I was very used to the fact, that Haifa is known as a coexistence city. It's a city that Jews and Arabs live side by side, peacefully. And this realization about the sign and me ignoring it made me realize that we don't really live in coexistence. We live in parallel existence. I've lived my life growing with my own language, my own culture, my own friends, not ever meeting an Arabic speaker and actually engaging in a conversation. And I wanted to see if I can do something about this. And I wanted to say something by using my own tools. I'm a typeface designer, I design letters. I wanted to see how letters can really say something. Something that is honest and true to me. And I was wondering how I can do it. How I can combine the Hebrew and the Arabic, both looking so different. The Hebrew is written separately, and the letters are very strict and consists of straight lines and angles, whereas the Arabic is written in a connected way, much more curvier, and has a lot of flow in it. How is it even possible to connect such two different scripts? I started looking at inspiration from design areas, looking at how two different things can connect. And what is this connection doing? Is the connection actually not doing anything? Maybe this connection is ruining both of the objects to a state that they're losing their essence. Or maybe, and this is what I was looking for, maybe this new connection is creating something new, something bigger than the sum of its parts. I still felt like I need something more, some theory behind this. And I remember the work of Dr. Louis-Emile Jeval. He was a 19th century ophthalmologist from France, and Jeval discovered something quite interesting. He discovered that in order to read Latin letters, you basically need the top part. Can you read it? Well, I can't because it's in Polish. Well, I was really intrigued by this idea, and I wanted to see maybe, just maybe, it applies to Hebrew as well. It did not. So if I'm looking at the top part of Hebrew letters, they all look very much alike, and it's very hard to read it. However, after a few minutes of this, I understood that maybe I should try looking at the bottom part of the Hebrew. And I saw that while looking at the bottom part of the Hebrew, most of the identifying characteristics are there. It's very easy to read Hebrew like this. Well, not very, but it is possible. And I went on to see what happens with the Arabic. And in the Arabic, I discovered that what you need in order to read is the top part, just like the Latin. I was really happy. I had my system for my new creation, for my new hybrid writing system. Each time, the top part will be dedicated to Arabic, and the bottom part will be dedicated to Hebrew. So if someone reads Arabic, they would look at the top part. And if someone reads Hebrew, they would look at the bottom part. But they would all read the same word with the same meaning. And I started connecting letters. Each time I took a top part of an Arabic letter, connected it with the bottom part of a Hebrew letter, creating one new hybrid letter that maintains the essence of each of the letters, while looking like something completely new. And this is how it was designed. This is the word safa in Hebrew, lura in Arabic, language in English. And this is how some of the words look. So you can maybe practice your Hebrew skills or your Arabic skills, or I can just tell you. But I can see some smiles here, so it means you can read. The words are hummus, Jerusalem, water, watermelon, Arabic, and Hebrew. This reads the same in Hebrew and in Arabic. And the idea is that in one single moment in time, someone can read Arabic and someone can read Hebrew, and they share this moment together. I quickly realized that in order to be able to write any word that I want, I would need to create all the possible combinations, every Hebrew letter with every Arabic letter, which brought me to the very small number of 638 new letters that I designed for this. And that was only the beginning. I started by saying that I don't speak Arabic, and the train in Israel had a very important role in the creation of Aravrit, this new hybrid writing system. Aravrit means Aravit and Ivrit, Arabic and Hebrew. These moments on the train, I would carry pieces of paper with Aravrit words on them, and whenever I heard someone speak in Arabic, I would approach them and ask if they have a few minutes to help me improve this system and test if it's even working. People gave me feedback. It was kind of a funny celebration on the train where people from all over the trailer would come and see and say what they read and what they can't read and how it's better to improve it even. These spontaneous moments were actually the first time for me that these parallel lines I was talking about, they began to meet. I started by designing Aravrit for myself, but quickly it began to resonate with people. People that don't even speak Hebrew or Arabic. People resonated with the message of this, of the fact that there is a message delivered through letters and through language. They wrote me that this project gives them hope. And they've got different inquiries from other places of the world. This is the story of Uri and Reka. You can maybe spot something on their necks. Uri is Jewish from Mexico, and Reka is Muslim from Lebanon. Uri and Reka became very good friends when they were traveling in Australia, and they decided that they're going to do one yearly trip. Every year, they're going to choose a location on the globe, a location where they don't have to be in their own countries with their own borders. They can just be two humans. They asked me to design the word human for them in Aravrit, so they can use it as a tool to display what they believe in every day. This was done in a project with the president of Israel, where we invited two children to write in Aravrit. Each of them started by drawing their own language and coloring their own language, but quickly, towards the end, they started mixing and merging and actually making this hybrid come to life. Aravrit is very natural for children. It's very easy for them, and in almost every school in Israel, it's taught somehow, whether in Arabic class or in creative thinking class. But not only children, adults also practice it. And they're trying to combine things and seeing what message they can say through letters. The bottom line of this project is that everyone can read the language that they feel comfortable, whether if it's Hebrew or Arabic. But still, you don't ignore the other script, which is always there present. And if we expand the scope for a minute beyond Aravrit, the same takeaway that is true for this hybrid system is true for our existence. We are here together. Our lives are intertwined, whether we like it or not. And accepting this can create a change in our mindsets, and then maybe even in reality. Thank you.
Thank you, Liron. It's beautiful. Maya, how many people here listen to podcasts? All of you. I say thank you. You're very good today, Michal. Podcast is like the new version to listen to radio. It's a radio that is always there. Okay, whenever you want to go online, you can hear this radio show. You don't have to tune yourself to the right time, to the right moment that the radio is on. So podcasts became very, very popular in the world. There's like great podcasts all over. People listen to it in many, 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 many numbers. And the princess of podcasts in Israel is standing right next to me right now. She has a podcast called Sipur Israeli, Israeli Story. And it's about Israeli stories. Now, there are many, many Israeli stories. How do you know which story is a good story? Well, if you go online to their podcast, you will know, you will get to hear the best stories. But what they do is that they do really great research on each and one of these stories. It's like a new way of journalism. It's really deep research. And they go and record the people of the story and then play it on the radio. Today, especially for Krakow and especially for this evening, Maya is going to do a live version of the podcast that we usually hear on the internet. That means that everything that you hear is done from this computer, and the narration that you usually hear from the radio studio will be done live here. And it's an amazing story, like all of your stories. Maya Kosover, please.
Thank you. So, this little girl you see in this picture here was born in 1953.
Okay, so I'm Lizzie Duron. Once upon a time I was Elizabeth. My mother wanted me to have a Gentile name, that I will have an option to leave the country and not to belong to the Jewish people. My last name was Ruja, after my father, but I never met my father.
She grew up in a small working class neighborhood in South Tel Aviv.
I grew up just with my mom as an only child, and I was surrounded by neighbors. They all came from there, which means the Holocaust. It was a very warm, cozy, and crazy neighborhood.
100 families lived there. Most of them had fled the Nazis. They had known each other from the ghettos, from the woods, from the camps, and now they were together again in Tel Aviv, Israel. So this neighborhood, you can imagine, wasn't quite like other neighborhoods. It had its own rituals and traditions. At night, people would go out the streets screaming of faraway terrors, and little Elizabeth would stand by the window, hidden by the curtains, and collect scattered bits of information.
These were my bedtime stories.
But in her own home, there was nothing but silence. She tried to ask, to inquire, but her tight-lipped mother, Helena, wouldn't cooperate.
I asked her where she came from, and it was just a short answer from the Holocaust. When I asked her, why aren't you celebrating your birthday? She used to answer, because I'm a dead walking person. When I wanted to know something about my father, she said that anyhow he's far away, and I didn't know whether that meant that he left or died.
But throughout her childhood, little Elizabeth had a strange feeling that she wasn't alone, that someone was looking at her, following her. She would occasionally see a face peering through her classroom window, and one day she and a bunch of friends were on the way to the center of town.
We were on the bus, and I saw someone that is running behind the bus and looking at me. It was the same face that I saw from time to time at school through the window.
Elizabeth got off the bus and started searching for this someone, looking behind every tree, every building, every bush in the neighborhood, but nothing. She wrote it off as a figment of her imagination, and out of embarrassment, she didn't mention any of it to her mother. They didn't talk much in general. They were surrounded by secrets and question marks, but Helena, her mother, wasn't silent about everything. When Elizabeth was 18, a young Israeli soldier fell in love with her.
He knocked on the door, and of course he came with the gun and with the uniform.
And then Helena looked at the young suitor and asked,
"How many Arabs did you kill?" And she shut the door on his face. And I stood in the middle of the room. I looked at her and I said, "But I'm in love. And he is the son of one of the chief generals in the Israeli army." And then she said, "That's the reason I don't want him to enter this house."
Each Holocaust survivor found their own way to deal with a traumatic experience. For Helena, it made her a pacifist. She didn't want nothing to do with violence of any kind. And Lizzie, who grew up as a patriotic Zionist, simply didn't get her mother.
And then I said to myself, okay, this is the time to take a suitcase and to leave.
So Elizabeth ran away as far as she possibly could. She reinvented herself as Lizzie, cutting ties with her mother and everything she represented. It didn't last. 3 years later, she came back home and to her mother. She went to university and met Danny. They fell in love and it quickly became serious.
I called my mom. I asked her to behave well. She promised. And we went to visit her. As usual, when she opened the door, she looked at him and she had to ask him, what was your job in the army?
So Danny stood at the door and shyly said that he had been a garbage truck driver.
And my mother had a wide smile on her face. And she looked at me and she said, I think you found your husband. I wanted to kill her.
A week later, Lizzie and Danny were engaged. They had two kids, a daughter and then a son. Lizzie got a master's degree and life went on. All the while, Helena kept her silence and her secrets to herself. Eventually, Helena became ill, and after 7 long months in the hospital, she passed away. She took her story with her to the grave.
Mi hu ha, 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 uv kolo hashchol, kol ze shir dechi, ze shir bechi, she sharim kula.
A few years later, Dana, Lizzie's daughter, got an assignment from school to make a family tree, a project researching the stories of her parents and grandparents. She asked a ton of questions about the family, but Lizzie didn't have any answers. So she returned to a childhood neighborhood and talked to some of the old neighbors. She sat down with a woman, an old friend of her mom's.
And I wanted her to tell me about my father. And she said, I have in my album a picture in which I see your father is looking at you and he was beyond the trees. And she showed me the picture.
You have also seen this picture at the beginning.
I just knew that this was the man I had seen following me, looking into our classroom and running after that bus.
Looking into this picture, she finally understood that man was her father, the father she never met. At the age of nearly 50, Lizzie started putting together the pieces of the mysterious puzzle which was her father. He survived the camps and arrived in Israel alone, battling tuberculosis. Back then, Helena was a nurse on a kibbutz, an Israeli agricultural commune, and she was in charge of giving all the newcomers their medical examinations.
And one day, this sick man came and told her that his last wish was to die as a kibbutz member. So my mom kept his secret.
When the kibbutz found out he was sick, they asked him to leave at once. This reminded Helena of other selections she had witnessed, and she couldn't remain silent.
She was not going to let this man die alone.
They left the kibbutz and moved in together in Tel Aviv. 2 years later, after Helena became pregnant, his tuberculosis took a turn for the worse. He moved into a sanitarium, and the doctor said it was a matter of months, but he ended up living for 8 more years. On better days, when he had enough strength to make it into Tel Aviv, he would watch his little girl from afar, like an invisible ghost. Everyone in the neighborhood, Lizzie later found out, knew about him.
Everyone but me.
שיתבעו האוניות, שישרף הפחד. אולי ניפול.
Thank you, Maya. Maya called Dana, the daughter, and told her that she's going to tell the story of here, of her mother and grandmother here. And then you were told that Lizzie was born here, that Helena was born here in Krakow, yeah, which we didn't know before that. And that Lizzie, Helena's daughter, is a famous author, and she lives half in Berlin and half in Israel, if we talk about Makom, and her books are also translated into Polish. So if you're interested, Lizzie Doron. That's the pacifist. Okay, so the next person, the next artist that we're having, I advise all the non-Polish speakers to have this, because this is going to be in Polish. I had the privilege of meeting Monica. Thank you. Or the other artist we know from Israel. Hello. So if you don't speak Polish, then you can have your headsets over here. And Monica will take us on a tour from a place here in Krakow that ends at the end in Jerusalem. Please, Monica. This is yours.
Dobry wieczór, good evening.
Good evening, shalom. When I was a little girl, my granny would feed beetroots to us, and in winter time, she would make beetroot juice. She would pickle beetroots. She would normally use in borscht in the soup, but also we also had this juice to drink all the time. And this beetroot juice, pickled beetroots, are very healthy, good for you. Beetroots also are very good, macroelements, vitamins, and so on. And when they are pickled, they are natural probiotic. And so eating beetroot and pickling beetroots and drinking this pickled beetroot juice is an act against gentrification and of food and the pharmaceutical industry that is so omnipresent. And when I became a mother, I started pickling beetroot for my kid.
Oh.
And we are talking about fermenting here, pickling by fermentation.
But then he's back.
Don't go back. We never want to go back. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Back. Take it. Good luck.
I'm sorry.
Well, sorry for that. Technology. No beetroot technology. Okay. So when I ferment these beetroots, I have to protect my table because beetroots make stains, horrible stains. I'd never wear white while doing it. And besides them being good for you, and the cheapest one-person format of a demonstration and a manifestation against the various things, they're best had in a package. But what I do, apart from beetroot, is I do textiles, I embroider, and I also subverse language, and I exhibit those textiles in public space. And one day there was this lady who came to visit, and she was an art curator, and asked me to ferment textiles, which was really something very unusual, a demand. I had never done that, and she didn't even know that I was fermenting these beetroots, because it was my private thing. So our meeting did not lead to any cooperation and fermenting textiles, but I went out of my studio, I went to the local marketplace, I bought 2 kilos of beetroot, and I started fermenting them. And these beetroots were round, and I thought maybe these beetroots, while they were fermenting, they could make a good stamp. I took a rag and I started stamping it with these beetroots. And it turns out that you could use this beetroot various things. Okay. So I did some exercising, I did some testing. That's my table where I do the fermentation. But I also have the various plants or flowers in vases. And I made a flag which looked a bit like a EU flag. So when this lady came back to Poland, I brought this flag. I decided to bring this flag that I fermented and I made, thanks to her request. But I didn't have this stick as a pole, a flagpole. So I was looking around, and one day before, I went to a walk in the park with my son, and they were cutting trees, they were trimming trees. So I brought one of these twigs, and I put in this vase. It was the only stick that was available for this flag. So I put this flag on this little stick, and I went to give this fermented flag, EU flag, to hand over to this lady. And then, you know, it looked like, you know, where the flag is hanging on this stick, it prevents the stick from further growth and sprouting new leaves. And for the stick to continue with whatever process is, it comes up together with water. So as like all the formal and legal structures that the EU creates, thus limiting relationships between individuals who'd like to cooperate and work together within the EU territory. So the fermented EU flag was stifling the stick's growth. So I made the flag into a tablecloth, and I put the stick back into this vase. And maybe 2 years passed, and they invited me to Bozard, which is a gallery in Brussels, to do something. And Bozard, this gallery, is very close to the European Parliament, and I decided that it was a great moment to do fermented EU flags. And let me also say that the beetroot, the word beetroot, is something that is somebody who is uncouth, uncultured, misbehaves, and also somebody from the countryside, like country bumpkin, for example, a lower class person. And often people who Poles who emigrate for work to Western countries are often called beetroots in Polish. So I went to this Bozard thing, gallery, and I bought 30 kilos of beetroots in the marketplace. And together with my husband, Grzesz, we brought them in a suitcase to Brussels. And for a few days, I fermented, I peeled and those beetroots, and I made flags. And the ready flag and the flag, when it was ready, looked like this. At the top of the gallery, there are 23 flags, if I remember, 2 by 3 meters. So I made 23 flags, and we replaced the flags, the EU flags and national and Belgian flags, with the beetroot flags. And after a while again, I was invited to Israel. I had never been to Israel, so I had my own ideas of what people, Polish-born people, people with Polish descent still lived in Israel, in Jerusalem, and I decided to create a workshop about the beetroots and the manifestation, demonstration of fermenting cheap vegetables. And I prepared this workshop, which sounds very good. Jerusalem meets Polish beet. And I was the Polish beetroot, because as it turned out, few people still spoke Polish in Israel. It's like, you know, that your ideas are not quite compatible with the reality. So I was the Polish beetroot to present the Polish beetroots to a wider public. But the concept of the EU flag didn't work in Israel, as you can imagine. So I decided, because of the geopolitical situation, I would make this beetroot juice that we would ferment during the workshop, flags that did not represent any country, but the idea of nationhood, of the idea of colonization, of appropriating ethnic of or national identities to expand your own culture. So these are the flags. To me, as a creator, as an artist, they are not flags of a country, but they represent the idea of a nationhood. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Wow. I moved the plant, I put it back. Let's see if this one works here. Okay, we have two artists left. Our next artist is a fashion designer, and I guess when we hear the word fashion designer, we have this kind of image in our minds, and this kind of industry and mass media and very commercial, and the ladies that are too thin, too much, way too thin. But Michal Hidash, she comes from Israel originally. She deals with fashion in a totally different way. Michal, please.
Hi, good evening. It's very good to be here. I'm very excited, and let's see if it's working. If it works, how do I? So my name is Michal Hidash, and I'm a fashion designer, as you already heard. And I try to give something that is more than just fashion. I create art, and it is wearable, it is functional, but with my art, I also try to let people wear some kind of message, something that I care about. My story starts in my hometown in Israel called Tivon. It's in the north of Israel. It's a beautiful place called the Israeli Valley. And I feel very, very lucky to be born there. I was born at the right time, at the right place, not 70 years ago, where my grandparents were born in Europe, and therefore they are Holocaust survivors. They have lost everything they had and everyone they had. And my father is also a refugee who ran away and came to Israel. My mother was born in Israel. And as I was born in Israel, I was born at the right place because I was born 5 meters to the right side of the border, not in Gaza, not in Syria, not in anywhere else. So after graduating from high school, I had a gap year in Jerusalem, and I was volunteering with youth and kids in Jerusalem, living together with 10 other volunteers. We did everything together. We ate together, we studied together, we worked together. And unfortunately, all the 10 of them got hurt badly in a terror attack. I was 2 minutes away from there. I was supposed to be with them, and luckily I was not. But when a terrorist, a Muslim terrorist, ran into them with a car and they all got hurt, I was, you know, just there. And in the following year, I spent helping them to recover and experiencing with them the trauma, the physical and the emotional one, because we lived in Jerusalem, and that was our neighborhood, our city, so where we felt at home, where we felt safe. But that was not anymore. Everything has changed. So then I had my mandatory military service, and my job was again to take care of soldiers who got hurt or got sick, or the families who lost their kids. And after 2 years like that, I felt that I need to do something that is just for myself. And I think that the same day, if not the day after, I started to study fashion design. Later on, I moved to Milan, the capital of fashion, where everything is happening. I suffered a lot just because I was an Israeli and a Jew, and people from my class didn't want to walk next to me or to talk to me even. They wanted to go outside the room, walk around and come back from the other side, and many other examples that I don't even want to share. But it was very, very sad, especially for me, knowing what my grandparents and my parents have been through. But I dealt with that. And then in one summer vacation, when I came back to Israel to visit my family, a war started between Gaza and Israel. So Gaza, it's in the south of Israel, and kids there, unfortunately, are used to be under bombing. And when the situation is getting worse and there is a war, they have those relaxation days where they take them from the south to the north. So one of those places is Tivon, my hometown. And we play with them, and everything is green and pastoral and beautiful. But as soon as something like this will happen, they will run away and hide and start to cry. And seeing that made me think that those kids are living this trauma inside of them. And I kind of know those kids because I was one of them, and I know how I grew up. I know that I grew up with internet and with the kids' channel and internet. And it's not that I know what is going on in the other side in Gaza. I just have no idea. So out of curiosity, I started to Google, and when I Googled in Hebrew, a war in Gaza, this is what I saw. I saw a picture, pictures of soldiers, heroic pictures, and the sunset, and something very heroic that I already knew because that's the narrative I grew up to. But as soon as I Googled in English exactly the same words, suddenly I saw the kids crying, the mothers, and something completely different. So I realized that in every language that I Google, I see a completely different narrative. What made me realize that I have to just communicate with people and ask them to create a direct connection. I continued to Google, for example, Gaza artist, because that's what I was interested in. And I saw all of this very, very depressing art, very gray and very sad, that it's just, we want to forget about it and just continue with our day, not to think about this war there, this gray and sad situation. I talked with many, many people, and all of them told me that they don't want to talk to me because I'm a murderer, I'm killing children, and many other things. And of course that I couldn't judge them because they know about me only what they've been taught, exactly as I don't know anything about them and their life. But I didn't give up. And after more than 6 months, I ran into this picture of a bombing in Gaza. And then I saw this work of art by this artist that made me feel, I don't know, just it's sad, but in some way also full of hope. And I created contact with him, And immediately, we just became friends. We never talked about politics. It was in 2014. And since then, we are communicating every day. We talk about our families. We talk about food, about music, about art, about culture, about everything that we love and we're interested in. Also the sad parts, but never about politics. As much as I will not talk about politics with my own brothers, because I don't want to fight with them. So we thought that it's actually very cool that we can be friends and we can communicate, and maybe we should share this story with more people. But unfortunately, we cannot meet in person because he cannot leave Gaza and I cannot go in. To be honest, he cannot tell anyone that he's in touch with me that he's doing something like that, not even his family or his closest friends. And I cannot share his name because it's too dangerous for him. Something can happen to him or to his families if they will know. So we thought a lot, what should we do? And we found this sentence in the Bible and in the Quran, talking about Abraham who passed away. And Abraham is the father of Isaac, who is the father of the Jews, and Ismael, who is the father of the Muslims. And they reunited together to bury him after he passed away. So we thought, this is exactly what we want to talk about. We don't want to reunite for death, for killing, for burying more people that we love. We want to reunite for love, for happiness, for creation, for art. And we started to collect together a visual inspiration that, as you can see, is very optimistic, even naive and colorful. Not like the art that we saw before, not this great thing that is just not attractive, and we don't want to talk about this. We wanted to find something that people would like to wear, would like to communicate with themselves and with others. So even though we couldn't meet, we started to create together. He's an architect and is teaching there in Gaza, in the university, freehand architectural drawings. So he started to create a series of freehand architectural drawings in a very, very small notebook that no one ever seen. And he scanned those pictures and sent them to me. I took his pictures and I made patterns out of them. And from the patterns, I made clothes. I never want to touch the colors, so as you can see, sometimes if the quality is not good enough, like that, I just do the negative. And we started to show everywhere, to have exhibitions and fashion shows, and I wanted him to come with me every time, but every time it was impossible for him to cross the border. Until only one time, that was incredible because he got a visit to the USA Embassy in Jerusalem, and it was the same night of the opening night of the Design Week in Jerusalem. So that was the first time that we met. It was the first time that he saw the clothes. It was the first time that he saw his drawings on the walls, and he saw 3,000 people just leaving the house to see art, to see design, which was very, very emotional and not clear to him, not obvious. And unfortunately, this is the only picture that I can show you from there because I cannot show you how he looks like or what is his name, as I said. But for him, a piece of his soul, as they say, a piece of his signature is traveling around the world and conveying the message. So many journalists were interested and shared this story, and it was amazing. And we didn't want to stop. We continued. And as I volunteer with Syrians who come to get medical treatment in the hospitals in Israel and in refugee camps in Europe, as you know now, it's a very serious problem that a lot of people are handling with. And I'm very, very inspired by them, by their hope and by their dreams. And I write a lot. I write their sentences that give me hope. For example, this sentence by a refugee saying, "A long silence could have been avoided." So this is one drawing by the Palestinian creative partner. And I gave this sentence also to a Jewish calligrapher called Max Noyes. He did his interpretation. Anyway, it's not... Come, maybe when I'm standing here. Okay, yeah, here it is. I will try. So this is his work of Max, the same sentence. I combine them together, even though also they never talked or never met. Yeah, it's not working, but you can show this part. And this is the pattern, for example, that I created. And this is the second collection that we did together. The collection's called Bridging. And I presented it in New York Fashion Week and also was honored to receive the Fashion Humanitarian Award. And I have to tell you that with all of that privilege that I feel also that I have a lot of responsibility to give voice to those who right now can't talk for themselves. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Michal.
Dziękuję, Michal. A poza tym to piękna sukienka. Dobrze. Nasza ostatnia artystka ma na imię Roni i będzie mówiła o Makom, o miejscu naszym tematem wieczoru. Ona zaczyna od swojego własnego domu, inspirowana przez ojca, potem wjedzie nas do Afryki i z powrotem tu do Krakowa. Shalom. Nazywam się Roni, jestem perkusistką. Będę mówiła o bębenku dżembe. Wychowywałam się z muzyką i bębnieniem w domu, ponieważ mój ojciec jako młody człowiek był perkusistą, grał w kapeli rockowej. Było długo przed moją urodziną, ale dotąd dźwięk, kiedy ojciec bębnił, co po wszystkim, co znalazł pod ręką, to jest soundtrack mojego życia. Także ta miłość do tego bębnienia, do tej perkusji było czymś, co jakby we mnie wykiełkowało. I później, kiedy wyszłam z domu, zacząłem szukać, chciałam studiować grę na perkusji, nie znałam w ogóle gry, nie grałam na instrumentach. Pierwszym moim nauczycielem był człowiek nazwiskiem Yisher i on grał na dżembe. On mnie zaprosił, ja nie znałam tego instrumentu i kiedy zobaczyłam ten instrument, to można powiedzieć, była miłość od pierwszego wejrzenia z tym instrumentem. Dżembe pochodzi od takiej frazy zachodnioafrykańskiej Anke dż, anke mbe, oznacza wszyscy razem. Razem w takim kręgu perkusistów poczułam coś, czego nie czułam nigdy wcześniej. To były wrażenia bardzo wielkiej siły, ognia, ziemi, głębi korzeni. Jakich korzeni, proszę Państwa, możecie zapytać. Nie jestem Afrykanką. W dużej mierze jestem, można powiedzieć, Polką, Szwajcarką. Stąd moje korzenie pochodzą. Kiedy się bębni przez wiele godzin, coś się dzieje z ciałem, z umysłem. Kiedy umysł zaczyna czuć ten ruch, to nie trzeba myśleć. Właściwie najlepiej nie myśleć, tylko grać. Ciało zaczyna czuć i rozumieć ten ruch i przez długi czas, kiedy się gra, co się dzieje? Tworzy się taka jasność w głowie, nowa przestrzeń się otwiera, przez którą może wejść nowa informacja. Ta informacja trafia z zupełnie innego źródła, innego miejsca. Czym jest to miejsce? Kiedy przez wiele godzin gram i ręce mnie po prostu bolą tak, że lepiej, żebym grała dalej, bo kiedy przestaję, zaczynam czuć ten ból, a jak gram, tego nie czuję, także lepiej grać dalej. Mój duch jest kierowany, to jest coś takiego prymitywnego, można powiedzieć, głębokiego. Kierunek to może być albo zagłębianie się coraz głębiej w rytm, nawet do poziomu wizji można mieć poczucie jakiegoś lotu, można być w danym miejscu i rozszerzać swoją obecność w kręgu perkusistów, bębniących, bębniarzy. I kiedy jakby w dalszej części mojej zaskakującej podróży z bębnem moja pasja rosła, coraz bardziej chciałam się wiedzieć, dowiadywać o tej wspaniałej kulturze. Zacząłam uczyć się z mistrzami dżembe i poczułam, że muszę pojechać do Afryki i rzeczywiście doświadczyć tej kultury u jej źródła, zobaczyć, poczuć, zobaczyć kolory, spotkać tych ludzi, doświadczyć tego miejsca, tego jedzenia, wszystkiego. I pojechałam więc do Afryki i tam na miejscu jedno z najważniejszych rzeczy, które zrozumiałam, było to, że muzyka nie jest rozrywką po prostu. To jest bardziej taki żywioł, jak powietrze, którym oddychamy. Sposób na życie też. My, Żydzi, podobnie jak inne ludy, narody, mamy swoją książkę, księgę, która tłumaczy nam naszą przeszłość, naszą historię tysiące lat wstecz. Ale w zachodniej kulturze wiele tych społeczeństw ma tylko i wyłącznie mówiony język, a nie pisany. Więc jak się pamięta, jak się nie ma księgi, jak się pamięta swoją historię? Setki, tysiące lat wstecz. Kiedy się, na tych zdjęciach Państwo widzicie coś, co nazywają griots. To są muzycy, którzy opowiadają historię. To jest tradycja zachodnioafrykańska, gdzie właśnie ci artyści mają przywilej pamiętania i opowiadania historii i bycia strażnikami historii. Od wczesnego bardzo wieku uczą się i zaczynają od najmniejszego elementu rodziny, potem wioski, potem kraju i potem imperium. I cofają się wstecz. Jak to robią? Poprzez śpiew, bębnienie i taniec. Każdy rytm ma jakieś znaczenie, to jest jakąś historię, to jest język. To nie jest po prostu coś, co brzmi dobrze w naszych uszach. Ma to głębsze znaczenie. I to jest przekazywane z pokolenia na pokolenia, od ojca na syna, od matki na córkę. I w ten sposób tradycje i wszystkie, cała ta historia, te historie są pamiętane i przekazywane. 20 lat temu, kiedy pierwszy raz położyłam moją dłoń na dżembe, na tym bębnie, jestem jedną z niewielu Izraele, które profesjonalnie grają na dżembe. I to oczywiście stworzyło taką pasję, żeby wprowadzać zmianę. I dwa moje największe projekty od tego czasu, jeden to było trio perkusistek, proszę, i większy zespół, 16 muzyków i tancerzy. Obydwie te grupy miały na swoim sercu wielki szacunek dla wspaniałej kultury Afryki Zachodniej. Zauważyłam, proszę Państwa, w taki naturalny i mistyczny sposób, większość moich studentek to kobiety. Widzę w ich oczach, że chcą zrealizować marzenie jakby tego właśnie bębnienia i osiągnięcia pewnej siły. Mam, muszę powiedzieć, przywilej, zwłaszcza w ostatnich latach, realizować swoją własną wizję, swoje własne marzenie tworzenia kręgów bębniarek kobiet i doświadczać tajemnicy pomiędzy kobietą a bębnem. To są kobiety we wszystkim, w każdym wieku. Młode kobiety, matki, babki.
Maybe we'll get back to.
Może wrócimy do filmiku, a jak nie, no to wy przyjdźcie na warsztat. Kiedy? My dogadamy się z administratorem festiwalu zaraz po naszym występie. Kolejna bardzo ciekawa rzecz, która się wydarzyła tuż przed naszą prezentacją, to, że kiedy się przygotowałem bęben, żeby wejść z nim na scenę, i Taj może wejść tutaj, żebyśmy zobaczyli, co się stało. Byłam mocno zaskoczona po ściągnięciu bębna, pierwszego bębna, na którym grałam, mojego dziecka od 20 lat, i proszę bardzo, co się tu stało? No niestety, a więc wspaniali ludzie z festiwalu, pan Paweł i jego ludzie zawalczyli i w ciągu kilku minut ściągnęli mi fantastyczny nowy bęben. Także bardzo dziękuję Pawłowi za właśnie jego działania. A tutaj krótki filmik z naszego warsztatu. Dziękuję. I na koniec chciałbym powiedzieć, że zrozumiałem, że granie na tych wspaniałych zachodnioafrykańskich bębnach daje znacznie więcej magii niż tej magii muzyki. To jest magia duchowa. To nie jest coś, co kiedy gram, to nie jest coś, co ja tworzę. To jest, ja umożliwiam to. Mogę wzywać jakieś duchy, mogę leczyć i uszczęśliwiać ludzi. I kiedy się gra, to uderzenie bębna mówi nam, kim jestem, po co tutaj przyszedłem, czy przyszłam. I dla mnie Afryka nie jest po prostu miejscem. To jest coś bardzo starego. Miejsce, które mamy wszyscy w swoim sercu. Kim to jest? Czym to jest, proszę Państwa? Zamknijcie Państwo teraz oczy. Wszyscy. Wciągnijmy głęboko powietrze razem. I pozwólmy, żeby rytm wniknął w nas głęboko, bo to nasze serce bije, wasze serca to bębny, i zachęcam was, żebyście szli za swoim bębnem, za swoim sercem. Dobrze, klaszczemy. Może jakiś rytm razem wyklaszczemy? Dobrze, okej, chcemy? Dobra, może w takim razie powiem coś o języku bębniarzy. To było coś fajnego. Powiem coś, a potem powiem, a potem wy powtórzycie. Ja potem będę śpiewać, a potem będziecie powtarzać.
Bumta, 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 bum. Tagadegi, digi, 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 bum. Plalalalalalam. All right, keep the clapping going.
Dobrze, klaszczemy. Dobra, i teraz dwie strony. Jedna, druga. Będziemy śpiewać i tworzyć rytm. Najważniejsze jest klaskanie. Ta strona, uwaga.
Yeah! This side.
Ta strona.
Pirim, pirim, pim. Pirim, pirim, pim. Pirim, pirim, pim. Yeah! Follow my lead.
Dobrze, i teraz ja pokazuję. Przestaniemy mówić i będziemy klaskać.
Moving to our hearts.
Słuchamy swojego serca.
Look around.
Popatrzcie na siebie. Popatrzcie na swoich sąsiadów. To jest to samo bicie, ale każdy ma swoje, a mimo to takie samo. Skończymy razem w 4, 3.
So we just want to say thank.
Może jeszcze raz podziękujmy wszystkim naszym dzisiejszym mówczyniom, pani Monika, Leroy, Roni, Maja i Mahaj. Gorące oklaski. Bardzo, bardzo dziękujemy za przybycie. Dziękujemy naszemu producentowi, naszemu edytorowi.